The following talk was given by Mary Sullivan at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on May 10, 2020. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Thank you all for coming. Happy Mother's Day, and I say that provisionally, maybe. If there's anything that the current circumstances are possibly teaching loud and clear, is that everything is provisional, showing up provisionally. So I offer the Happy Mother's Day provisionally. And if that resonates with any of you, I'd like you just to ponder that quietly, wordlessly if possible, and consider it in the context of some of the things you may have heard on Zoom recently, Steve's wonderful talks on mountains are not mountains, rivers are rivers, mountains are not mountains, rivers are not rivers, mountains are mountains and rivers are rivers. This is a teaching on the provisional nature of reality as it's constantly showing up and changing, as well as a teaching on absolute truth. You know, with regard to my students, well, anyway, there have been other wonderful discussions, like for those of you who are in the Two Truths class, some of the things Steve has said in this class have resonated with me in ways I had not expected. I've been sitting with these teachings for a long time, and it's like suddenly I hear them. I hear them in an entirely different way, and I can't explain this. And I bet many of you have had this experience. And don't try to explain it. Just pay attention to it. You can file it away. It'll show up when you least expect it. So with regard to my student status, I want to say this. I've been somewhat chafing against being called a student here at Dharma Field. And I realized last night why that is. I have been a perpetual student here at Dharma Field. I've taken dozens and dozens of classes. And when I was in college, and I'm not going to say when that was, but it was a while ago, being called a perpetual student was absolutely a huge insult. It implied that you were unwilling, or I was unwilling, to take on the responsibilities of graduating and then becoming an adult and assuming a whole new set of adult responsibilities. And I remember once the father of a woman I was in high school with, when I told him I was going to go on to get a master's degree, he said, he accused me of being a professional student, a perpetual student. Not only did I get a master's degree, but then I went on to pile it higher and deeper. So I've really lived up to that epithet, that name. But here at Dharma Field, it's a different deal. As I said, I'm constantly learning. I hear things that I've heard people say over and over and over again, and I hear them in fresh new ways. And I can't explain this. I cannot explain this. But anyway, to return to Mother's Day, which I will, I feel like, I was thinking last night, I feel like a mother hen who's lost her brood, whose chickens have gone missing. I'm the Friday night Doan. That means that I open up Dharma Field for meditation on Friday nights. I prepare the Zendo. That can entail a variety of responsibilities depending upon what season it is, whether anyone has signed up for Dokusan. I set up for Dokusan. I ring the bell to indicate that there are intervals of time before formal meditation will begin. I start the meditation, I close doors, start the meditation with a bell, end it sitting, start walking, all of this with bells, repeat the process. On Friday nights, we recite either the Fukan Zazengi or Trusting the Heart Mind. So in the spirit of a mother hen who misses her chicks, I want to say hello to my Friday night group, the regulars and mostly regulars, Catherine, wherever you are. I hope you're well. Anne, I can see you. I did see you at one point. Kyle, Bill, I saw Bill. I'm glad to see you, Bill. Jonas and Bruce, Matt and Matt. We have any number of Matts. The first two Matts are friends from way back. Then there's a third Matt, who's the Sunday Kitchen Tenzo. Let's see, Jeff and Michael and Elaine and Charlie and my husband and Steve and Norm. I just wanted to say hello to you all, that I miss you in the spirit of being your mother hen on Friday nights. So I have to say that last night I was trying, I've been thinking about this talk now since at least the end of March, but I've been unable to write anything down. I've had a hard time with writing things down. And last night I started to write things down and it became incoherent. And my cat jumps up in the middle of where I'm sitting and writing and is trying to get my attention and wanting me to pet her. She's shedding all over what I'm writing. Her hair is everywhere. And I realized that what I was writing was somewhat incoherent. So I'm just going to sort of wing it. But I'm going to start with something I really heard for the first time that I think came out of one of Steve's lectures on the two truths, or it might have been in one of his recent talks on Zoom, but it's the phrase dependent upon conditions. Dependent upon conditions. If anything, the current circumstances have taught us, particularly the virus itself, highly dependent upon conditions to manifest. We've been learning many things about this virus. Unfortunately, some people by extremely direct experience. And we've learned that this virus manifests itself dependent upon conditions. And those conditions are the conditions of the host. We have the host and the virus. They're mutually interdependent. And it can show up as fever. It can show up as sore throat, as coughing, as stroke, as inability to breathe, as a weight on one's chest. And so it's a very protean virus, but it is totally dependent upon conditions. And that interrelationship, that play between the host and the virus. Jin Ching Ming calls this the thoroughgoing relativity. And this is pointing right to emptiness. For those of you who are taking Steve's class on the two truths, he does such a wonderful job of talking about this in the context of Nagarjuna, in the context of the Heart Sutra. I think that class is even available, still open, still available. But that dependent upon conditions, this is how anything can possibly show up, including the virus, including sickness, including health, sickness and health. That's another thing. Norm has given talks on, or at least one talk, on the eight winds. These are conditions that we tend to get tossed around by. Health versus sickness, wealth versus poverty, reputation versus disgrace. I can't think of the other ones. But these are, it's a beautiful teaching on interdependence, on conditions, on how things are relative to one another. And without the conditions necessary for things to show up, nothing would show up. Steve talked about this in The Two Truths recently. And it's a complex, subtle teaching, this thoroughgoing relativity that's originally one emptiness that the Xin Qing Ming talks about. We tend to think of this when we have a mind, but Steve was actually talking about this in terms of our mind. When we have a mind that is dependent upon conditions, as talked about in the eight winds, this is a mind that's easily disturbed, a mind that's easily confused. I'm not offering this as a criticism, because I'm going to talk about some of my own experiences recently. This is not a criticism. This is just a teaching, a helpful pointer. So a mind that is dependent upon conditions is a mind that's tossed around or tossed about by particular circumstances, whether it be when things are going smoothly, running smoothly. And I know this has been an extremely difficult time for many people, and my heart goes out to them. But nonetheless, there is this other aspect to it, this returning, as Norm calls it. Well, first, let me just say that in this teaching, this very subtle teaching on interdependency, this can show up. We overlook things, and one of them is that, as Norm puts it, all beings are mutually assisting each other. All beings are mutually helping each other. This is a difficult teaching, but without this mutual assistance, without this all beings helping, assisting, nothing would show up. This is the essence of that teaching. And you know, you can hear this over and over again, and it may not resonate. And then all of a sudden, it starts to make a little bit of sense. This is what Steve has talked about recently as Tathagata. Tathagata is not just the name that the Buddha gave to himself, this coming and going to refer to himself as nothing to get hold of, this coming and going thus, this looks like coming, looks like going, as Katagiri puts it. This is thoroughgoing relativity, thoroughgoing interdependence, emptiness. And this applies to everything. This is not just a name given to the Buddha. This is our nature. This is the nature of reality. This is you. This is me. Without the you and the me, without the I. I don't know. I find this hearing these things, I don't know how to put it, helpful, very helpful. Another phrase that has come to mind recently that has made more sense in the context of the current circumstances, I have to say I have found them very demanding. I still go into work because I'm considered necessary personnel where I work. Where I work in downtown St. Paul has been closed to the public now, the building, for quite a few weeks. A lot of the people I work with, the docs, psychologists, the other psychologists, have been teleworking. And that requires, I have to confess, the thought of being stuck at home filled me with such anxiety. Given the choice of either teleworking or coming into work, I chose to come into work. But these circumstances have been very demanding. And David and I have started meditating together on a weekly basis, on a daily basis. We've committed to that. And one thing I've noticed is my quickness to react. Everything seems speeded up somehow when I look at my mind. It seems I go from zero to panic, or zero to rage, or zero to overreaction in 4 nanoseconds. I find this fascinating. So another phrase that has come to mind and has taken on, I don't know what word to apply to it, has been helpful, is the phrase wordless awareness. I remember struggling with this expression, wordless awareness, and discussing this with another Dharma Field member, Cynthia. Wordless awareness. It's sort of like when Dogen talks about think not thinking in the Fukan Zazengi. There's resistance there. This wordless awareness, when I look at that, when I look at my own, suddenly this quickness to fear, this quickness to rage, it's being fueled by what I tell myself. Norm talks about returning, just coming back, returning to the practice of here and now reality, returning to awareness. And when the things that I tell myself, when I drop that, when I let go of that, and there's just the allowing whatever is showing up to show up without my commenting on it. So fast, all of the rage, all of the fear drops away in that moment, in that very moment. But I've been struck by how quickly all of this is happening lately. Yesterday, I went into work with the intention of writing something down for this talk, and that failed. But on the way in, I was driving east on 94 and coming west on 94. It happened, not quite in slow motion, but a big green Jeep hit the concrete divider with its left front fender, and pieces go flying. And it wasn't in slow motion, but it was so vivid. The experience was so vivid. Before I could even react, I was stunned, just utterly stunned by the vividness of it. And then, of course, I think to myself, well, what if the divider hadn't been there? I was not next to the divider in the left lane. The Jeep had been in the left lane going west on 94. I was in the middle lane going east. And then the guy behind me is in a huge hurry for me to get out of his way. And I'm thinking, didn't you just see that? But it's amazing the things we miss when we're not paying attention. It's amazing. And I think, gosh, I'm not sure it matters what I think anymore. I recently had to prepare a talk, actually two talks, to the new class of examiners where I work. So because I'm a psychologist, and because we sometimes give the people to whom we provide services IQ tests, the examiners have to know something about what the scores mean. I gave them a talk on the normal distribution. I am a psychologist. I had to take statistics. You know, you'd think it was very boring, and it is very boring, and I warn them that this is very boring. But after I had just finished reading, in the course of thinking about what I was going to say to the examiners, I had just finished reading a section from Katagiri's book, The Light That Shines Through Infinity, and it's edited by Andrea Martin. And in that, there's a particular section where Katagiri talks about returning to zero. And for some reason, a statistical analogy came to mind. You may think, oh, brother, that's so intellectual, but it was incredibly helpful. So when you have a normal distribution, for those of you who are at all familiar with the concept of intelligence, it's normally distributed in the population, which means that the zero point of the scale using a Z-score is the point at which most of the people fall if you have a big enough sample. So the zero point of a Z-score scale, is dead center in the middle. But you cannot have that dead center zero point without the extremes. They make no sense whatsoever without that Z-score of zero. As you go out to the right and people get smarter under the curve, and there's a drop off in the number of people, and there's a plus sign. The Z-score starts to increase by increments with a plus sign in front of it. And as you move to the left and people are less intelligent, and there are fewer and fewer people, as you drop away from that zero point to the left and to the right, but it's totally meaningless. The extremes are totally meaningless without that zero point, without that middle point of the distribution. And so in his talk, in his discussion of returning to zero, somehow that just made a huge amount of sense. And what Katagiri is talking about, he was actually talking about having few desires, having few desires. And oh my God, this is embedded in so many. So David's laughing. having few desires. So we have this zero point, and then we have the extremes of desirelessness and many desires. And as you know, the first bodhisattva vow is to save all sin. No, the second bodhisattva vow is to be released from all desires, though they are inexhaustible. That vow is a vow to return to the zero point. That vow, the practice of Zazen, is returning to the zero point. Because as you just let go of expectations, as you let go of requirements for happiness, as you let go of in this moment, as you let go of the things we bring with us when we sit down to meditate, and it doesn't matter what they are, and it's fine that you do. As we just let those things go and return to the zero point, we can start to notice there are a few desires there. This is the zero point. This is returning to zero. And there was something I actually forgot to say with regard to dependent upon conditions in the practice of meditation. In the practice of meditation, one of the, I don't know, cardinal rules, and I use the word rules very loosely, is that we practice with regularity. This is a mind that, this is to help us, to train us, to literally to discipline us in not being so dependent upon conditions. So we set up a meditation practice, and regardless of whether we want to do it, regardless of how we feel, regardless of how we feel after we meditate, regardless of how we feel during meditation, we commit to that schedule. And that's regularity of practice. And what that is doing is breaking our dependence upon conditions, which tends to influence what we do in everyday life if we're not paying attention, when we're not aware. I mean, I don't mean to lecture. I know I sound like I'm lecturing. I'm just telling you what I've been learning over the past couple of months in the absence of actual physical contact with my Sangha and my teachers. Well, I've made it to 10:30. So I'm going to read you what I consider to be a Mother's Day story. Thank you for smiling, James. So in this Mother's Day story, this is taken from Katagiri's book, You Have to Say Something. And we've discussed this piece actually in Chozan during practice period. I recently emailed this piece to someone to whom I thought it would be particularly I don't even know what the word is. It doesn't matter.
Inspirational.
Inspirational. Yeah, that's good. Thank you, David's helping me here. Inspirational. So this is an entire brief chapter. And the title of the chapter is Inconceivable Cosmic Life. And here's how it starts. This is from Katagiri's book, You Have to Say Something. Hang on. So he starts out, a student sent me a letter that told the story of a Chinese nettle tree in Hiroshima in an area called Motomachi. The tree was struck by the blast of the atomic bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima in 1945. It had no branches or leaves, but at the beginning of May of 1985, it began to put out buds. A sign in front of the tree reads, "The atom bomb turned even this Chinese nettle tree into an ugly thing. It has continued to survive until today. The poor little tree has known the strength and value of life. We who live in Motomachi have a duty to protect this tree. And there's a sign underneath the tree that reads, the Motomachi Primary School Children Association. Katagiri goes on to say, over the years, the children of this school carefully protected this tree. This is why I think this is a Mother's Day story. There's a role reversal here. It's the children doing the mothering. In 1982, an old tree surgeon named Yamano heard about the tree. He was known for having previously revived nearly 900 old and famous trees. And it was said that he could tell if a tree was still alive just by feeling it. According to Yamano, trees know the hearts of people. He also says that trees will keep on living if they're allowed. The nettle's only remaining root was the main one at its center. All the surrounding roots had withered away, but as soon as Yamano touched the tree, he knew he could revive it. He dug deep around the central root, injected a nutritional solution, and filled in new earth. He told everyone that the tree would put out new buds without fail. Then he left. As he promised, the tree put out buds. The life, Katagiri goes on to say, the life of this tree is inconceivable. But it's not just this tree whose life is inconceivable. Humans, rocks, birds, air, and all beings have the same universal cosmic life. When we see a tree with just our physical eyes, we make judgments about it and speculate on the nature of its life or its death. Like so, we make judgments about everything, rocks, birds, other people, and so on. The list is endless, based on our notions of what is alive and what is dead. But we ignore the vast, great, inconceivable life that is behind our ideas of life and death. From this perspective, the life and death we commonly distinguish are not different. Even though we may call something dead, it is not real death, real with a capital R. In his text, there is actually life there. The Chinese nettle gives us a good example. For 40 years, it was a dead tree, and then it bloomed. Instead of being tossed about by our speculations about life and death, and here he's talking about being dependent upon conditions, instead of being tossed about by conditions, by our speculations about life and death, he says, we have to take responsibility for our capacity to see inconceivable life. Isn't that a phenomenal thing? We have to take responsibility. That is our responsibility. We have this capacity to see inconceivable life, to experience it, to be it. And we have to take responsibility for that capacity. He says, in Buddhism, we have the practice of shamatha, vipassana, meditation. Shamatha means tranquility or stillness. Vipassana generally means insight. But before I go on to what he says about vipassana, I just wanted to say that shamatha, tranquility, tranquil sitting, it's part of what we are talking about when we talk about shikantaza. Tranquility, tranquil mind is part of that. And by virtue of its absence, in some ways, from my life, I've come to appreciate it. And then he goes on to talk about vipassana. Vipassana generally means insight, but vipassana actually has two meanings. One refers to what we can experience through our bodies and minds, what we call worldly experience or worldly truth, as Steve Hagen refers to it, relative truth. The other means direct participation in inconceivable life. So this is Zazen, direct participation in inconceivable life. This is our practice. And he says, it may seem helpful to use Vipassana, which is our tendency to use things to achieve some other unrelated thing or accomplish it or get it or take it. It may seem useful to use Vipassana merely as a means to participate in inconceivable life, but that's not the final goal. The final goal, and he means, doesn't necessarily mean goal in the way we usually think of goal, is that your worldly life must merge with inconceivable life through actual realization. So this is what Norm talks about when he talks about returning over and over again to actual, immediate, direct, here now reality. That is merging our worldly life with inconceivable life through actual realization. We all do this. We're all capable of this. If you've ever taken Steve's class or read Steve's book on meditation, he's talking about this. Every single one of us has this capacity to realize inconceivable life. And then Katagiri says, before we conceptualize and separate ourselves from the world, there is something inconceivable. There is already universal cosmic life. It is why you are alive. Just remember the Chinese nettle tree. According to our judgments, the tree was dead, yet it was actually alive. But where is this life and this death? They worked together for 40 years. They work together still, as they do in all things. There is a power in the Chinese nettle tree that is not a part of the tree. It is not in the tree, nor is it outside. Whatever we may think about this, beyond our ideas of life, of the life or the death of this tree, there is an inconceivable world supporting this tree and allowing it to survive. It is a place where life and death work together beyond all our thoughts and speculations. Although we don't know how, after 40 years, the dead tree blooms. We listen to such stories and judge them impossible. But despite all our judgments, the dead tree blooms. This is why we sit in Zazen, not that we have to have a reason or should have a reason. This is just sitting in Zazen. In the truth of Zazen, life and death are merging moment after moment. And thus, because our lives are supported by all beings through the merging of life and death, we bring forth inconceivable life. So that's the end of the chapter. So there's a tree. So David and I live on the seventh floor of an apartment building, and our apartment faces the back parking lot. But there are two trees, and they've been growing. And the one tree on the left has just shot up, and it's all beautiful leafy green. And then there's the tree to the right of us, to the right of that tree, its neighbor. Every year, we worry about that tree. We watch it carefully. There was one year when David gave it extra nutrition. I'm trying to talk him into getting some more because it continues to lag behind its neighbor. And just today, after the rain we had yesterday, I can see the buds are starting to get a little bigger. We've even considered hugging the tree, and I'm not kidding. I've been so desperate for this tree to do as well as its neighbor. So I've been caught up in my ideas of what it should be doing and what it's actually doing without my actually having. So this is based on my ideas about what is going on with this tree. So now I'm just carefully observing, watching this tree, seeing how its buds are getting a little bit bigger, a little bit bigger. I think I'm done. It's 1:45. Usually my talks are about 45 minutes long. It's almost 1:45. So I think I'm going to open it up for questions or comments, and that's up to the moderator, not me, thank goodness.
All right. Well, thank you, Mary, for your wonderful talk. And right, as Mary said, we can open this up if people have questions or comments. Please make them. Remember, use your Zoom hand-raising tool. Susan, it looks like you have a question. Go ahead.
Mary, thank you so much for your talk this morning and for being in the front line during this COVID crisis. As a psychologist, we appreciate the work that you're contributing to the mental health of everyone who's affected by this. My observation and question regards what I too experience as a quickness to react, going from zero to overreaction in a matter of milliseconds. And I understand that the conditions involved in my overreaction are perhaps in part due to maybe not spending enough time on the meditation cushion, where I understand this connection between when I'm meditating and thoughts arise, I'm able to return my attention to either my breath or my posture or just being in the space. But when I'm in situations outside of the meditation cushion or my room, when I'm in the real world and I'm having a situation to respond to, it's much more challenging to return my attention to just the moment and to respond skillfully. Could you comment on, from your experience in psychology in particular, but how I can more skillfully respond in those real world moments when I'm not on the cushion, but am having to temper my reaction?
So thank you, Susan. I have a number of things to say about that, and I don't know if I'm going to be helpful or not. The first thing is the distinction that you make between real life and sitting on a cushion. I feel the necessity to point out to you that that's an artificial distinction. It's not as though we've stopped participating in real life when we're sitting on the cushion. If anything, we are fully participatory in inconceivable life on the cushion as off the cushion. There is no distinction. That's a distinction that we have artificially created. And maybe psychologists are more prone to that than other people. And to be honest with you, I'm not doing anything in the way of counseling people or trying to help them that way. My job is entirely in an entirely different capacity. And I try not to rely on my experience as a psychologist to help me with my reactions, my overreactions, my tendency these days to go from zero to rage or zero to panic in 4 nanoseconds. Psychology doesn't help me in any way. None. There's nothing I can rely on. This is what I'm starting to hear, and I'm starting to work it out for myself, and I hesitate to use those words. Don't hang on to anything I just said. I'm trying to hear when people like Norm and Steve talk about, well, the Xin Qing Ming. What is the Xin Qing Ming? It's what we recite every other Friday night. The title of that is Trusting the Heart Mind. This is our experience. But we have such a hard time trusting experience because our tendency is always to trust, or not always, I should not say always. Our tendency is typically to trust what we think and not what we're actually experiencing when we're not thinking, when we're not conceptualizing, when we've let go of whatever ideas we've brought with us. And it doesn't matter what we're doing. I can get carried away in thought, feeding my cats. I can get carried away in thought. I can put a cup of coffee in the microwave, turn it on, walk away, and forget about it. It doesn't matter. Just coming back, just being fully attentive, paying attention, just being fully engaged with the moment, not separate from the moment. The words I use are misleading because words obfuscate. They confuse. They divide things up. And Norm is always pointing to, we have these ideas and beliefs about a limited, dualistically structured, divided up reality that doesn't correspond at all to the limitless, boundless nature of the reality that we're always experiencing. So just by turning our attention to what we're actually doing is allowing experience to teach us. And so I try hard not to rely on anything I learned in psychology because I feel led astray by it. And I'm sorry if I don't mean to sound harsh. I'm just trying to tell you what I'm doing at this point. I hope that was helpful in some fashion.
Are there any other questions or comments? Thank you, Mary, for your answer. And thank you, Susan, for your question. Any other questions or comments from people? Yeah, Martin, you have a question. Go ahead.
Yeah, so it seems that the 0 to anger in 4 nanoseconds thing is very experiential. It would seem to me that, you know, that's trusting your experience, yet I find it difficult to accept that that is in somehow the best way to respond, just following an emotional roller coaster. Can you say something about that? Oh, hi, Mary, by the way. Long time no see.
Hi, Martin. It's good to see you. I like your shades.
Thank you.
So it's not. That was my whole point. My whole point is that I'm just noticing that this quickness, this 0 to rage or fear, 0 to panic, in 4 nanoseconds or milliseconds or whatever, is being fueled by what I'm telling. So I start talking to myself immediately. I start making comments about, I make judgments, I have opinion, and they kick in before actually letting go. There's a conscious attempt to let go. And sometimes, a lot of the time, I'm not successful before things have escalated, but then there's the catching. Yes, that's experience, but there's also the interplay with my reaction to conditions, to being dependent and driven by conditions. The driver behind me who's honking, who's right up against me. I don't know if you're experiencing this here, but now that there are so few people on the road, it's construed as a liberty to drive as fast as anybody feels like driving. But there's this judgment that's being made that I become aware of when I'm that fast to respond emotionally, when I'm that driven by the anger or the fear or the whatever. So noticing that is in its of itself, letting go. Noticing that is learning from experience, because as soon as I drop that, so fast, the rage drops away, the fear drops away. It's as fast as the lead up to the rage and the fear. But dropping whatever it is I'm saying to myself at the time that's fueling it, all of a sudden, bam, there's just the stillness, the tranquility. And that's not to say I can maintain it. I can't maintain anything, but there's just that experience. I don't know, does that address your question at all?
It does. That's a lot clearer. Thanks.
You're welcome. Good to see you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Martin. And thanks again, Mary. Any other questions or comments? Anne, you have a question or comment? Let me get you ready here. Go ahead, Anne.
Mary, I just wanted to thank you for this talk. I think you, for me, you wove together the idea of conditions from beginning to end in your talk, and particularly for sharing your experience in going from zero to whatever the reaction is so fundamental, I think, for all of us, that I think it's very courageous and insightful of you to give us that experience of yours. So thank you, and I miss you too.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Anne. Thank you.
All right, well, I think that'll do it for today. Let me just make a few announcements.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.